director of the world premiere of Jump, co-produced by Confrontation Theater and the Milagro Theater. The play runs from March 21st through April 13th at the Milagro Theater in Portland. Jump is the story of a 20-something who is reeling from the death of her mother. She is looking for solace in a good place to vape, but what she finds is a journey of self-discovery. Again, that's Jump, every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday from March 21st through April 13th at the Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM here in Portland, K220 HR Hood River, 91.9 FM, K282BH Philomath at 104.3 FM, and we are in the midst of our spring membership drive, as you just heard from Ani and Jenna. Call that number, 877-500-5266. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from the Portland State University Hatfield School of Government, offering a master's degree in public administration for those who want to create efficient and inclusive cities, government agencies, and nonprofits. More information online at pdx.edu/Hatfield School. And now it's Rising Up with Sonali.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. In today's news headlines, the Washington Post reported that, according to Department of Homeland Security officials speaking anonymously, the Trump administration last November considered busing undocumented immigrants apprehended at the border to so-called sanctuary cities in the U.S. According to the paper, the move was part of a plan to, quote, retaliate against President Trump's political adversaries, and that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's district in San Francisco was among those the White House wanted to target. Officials at the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, or ICE, were apparently alarmed by the idea and rejected the plan. Although a White House official told the paper that the idea was briefly discussed and no longer under consideration, President Donald Trump on Friday tweeted, "Due to the fact that Democrats are unwilling to change our very dangerous immigration laws, we are indeed, as reported, giving strong considerations to placing illegal immigrants in sanctuary cities only." A spokesperson for House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the extent of this administration's cynicism and cruelty cannot be overstated. Using human beings, including little children, as pawns in their warped game to perpetuate fear and demonize immigrants is despicable. In other immigration news, NBC News reported on Friday morning that at a gathering of national security advisors this week, Trump officials considered using the U.S. military to build tent encampments to hold migrants in detention and discussed whether it was legal to let the military run the camps. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, meanwhile, on Thursday has called for talks with Democrats to take on immigration laws. He said, "What we need to do is sit down in a serious, adult, bipartisan basis and try to fix the problem, because the problem is pretty obvious. Border security is a part of it, but that doesn't solve the asylum issue, and that can't be solved, I don't think, without some kind of statutory adjustment." President Trump has claimed that immigrants are surging at the border, a claim that some critics called a manufactured crisis. He has also attempted to force DHS officials to break asylum laws. News also emerged that Trump is reportedly considering Julie Kirchner, the former executive director of the Federation for American Immigration Reform, to head the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. Kirchner's organization was deemed a hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. In other news, a federal judge sentenced a man named W. Samuel Patton on Friday to probation for steering $50,000 from a pro-Russian Ukrainian politician to Trump's inaugural committee. Patton was a political consultant hired by the Trump campaign, and the case involving him was one of many that have spun off from the special counsel's investigation. Patton pleaded guilty to the charge of moving a $50,000 contribution from a Ukrainian politician backed by Russia. His probation sentence lasts 3 years and includes community service and a nominal fine. On Thursday, a man named Greg Craig was indicted by a federal grand jury in a case that also sprung from the Mueller investigation. The 74-year-old attorney is the highest-level Democrat to be indicted and involves false statements and work he did for Ukraine. Meanwhile, in an interview with the Wall Street Journal, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein spoke out about the criticism that his boss, Attorney General William Barr, is coming under over the Mueller report. Rosenstein told the paper, "He's being as forthcoming as he can, and so this notion that he's trying to mislead people, I think, is just completely bizarre." Conservative outlets have seized on Rosenstein's words after spending months maligning him. Researchers at Clemson University, in collaboration with the Washington Post, have concluded that there was a concerted campaign headed by the Russia-based Internet Research Agency to convince supporters of Senator Bernie Sanders to vote for Donald Trump in 2016. One example is a tweet from an account called Red Louisiana News that read, "Conscious Bernie Sanders supporters already moving towards the best candidate, Trump. Hashtag feel the burn, hashtag vote Trump 2016. The extent of the campaign to target Sanders' supporters was much larger than previously known. Pizza magnate, Republican presidential candidate and Trump supporter Herman Cain is reportedly withdrawing his name from consideration of a Federal Reserve Board seat. Trump's nomination of Cain came under broad criticism from both Democrats and Republicans for him being utterly inappropriate for the position, but it was apparently GOP members that actually tanked his nomination. Trump also nominated another equally unqualified nominee for a vacancy on the same board, Stephen Moore. But Moore, who is white, appears to not be facing as much opposition from Republicans yet as Cain, who is black. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine on Thursday signed into law a so-called heartbeat bill, making his state one of a growing number of Republican-controlled legislatures that are passing unconstitutional abortion bans. The bill, named the Human Rights and Heartbeat Protection Act, according to critics, tramples on the human rights of actual humans, namely the pregnant women it would apply to. Like similar laws being passed in states like Georgia, Kentucky, and Mississippi, it claims that fetal tissue is equivalent to a human being. The laws are all expected to be legally challenged, a move that anti-abortion advocates say is part of their plan to mount a federal challenge to Roe v. Wade at the U.S. Supreme Court. Leading Democrats on Thursday announced plans for a broad $2 trillion plan to upgrade aging infrastructure all over the U.S., including roads, bridges, and schools. White House spokesman Judd Deere told Reuters that Trump met with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and, quote, agreed to meet soon to discuss working together on infrastructure. Republicans want to spend about half as much as Democrats do. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said, "I'm all for taking infrastructure legislation up once the president and Democrats, everybody, says, okay, here's how we're going to pay for it. As soon as that magically appears, I think we have a way forward." McConnell has rarely, if ever, raised the question of how to pay for expenditures that involve war funding and defense contracts. The Chicago Sun-Times on Thursday released a surveillance video it obtained showing a brutal police beating of a high school student at Marshall High School on the West Side. The shocking video shows two police officers dragging the black 16-year-old girl down a set of stairs, punching her repeatedly, and then tasing her. Officers had initially released statements claiming that the girl, Denigma Howard, had initiated the violence, but the new video contradicts their claims. The girl's family has hired lawyers to sue the district. The U.S. Supreme Court, in a 3 a.m. decision on Friday morning, ruled in a narrow 5-4 vote allowing the execution of an Alabama death row prisoner to proceed. The inmate in question, named Christopher L. Price, was scheduled to be killed on Thursday evening. He had asked for his death to be administered by nitrogen gas instead of by a three-drug cocktail known to cause excruciating pain. The New York Times explained that the replacement of Anthony M. Kennedy, who was a moderating force in capital cases, with a more conservative Justice Brett Kavanaugh, has hardened the divide between the two sides. And finally, the Justice Department on Friday said that General Electric will pay $1.5 billion in fines related to its role in the subprime mortgage crisis. And that does it for our news headlines today. We'll be back with the rest of the...
You are listening to Rising Up with Sonali, an all-woman radio and television show out of KPFA in Los Angeles. And this is Lenita Duke to talk about supporting KBOO during our spring membership drive.
Welcome, 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 and thank you for joining us here. I don't know, Aaron, do you know how we've been on the air for 50 years?
50 wonderful years.
And this is our 50,000th pledge drive. And we really need your support. We have some wonderful gifts. Now, we have some bomb T-shirts. We got Press Watch T-shirt, Democracy Now! T-shirts, and the KBOO logo T-shirts. We have wonderful books for just a $60 pledge, Empowering Women Politically or Radicalizing Powerful Women. Where's my assistant at? Anyway, the bottom line is we need your support. We need to keep KBOO's power running. Now, I'm from Grassroot News, and I've been down here at KBOO since 1979. I raised my daughter down here. Now, I had a 10-year hiatus because if you listen back to my archive show, I spent a lot of time criticizing KBOO on the air. Now, what station can you do that? Only at KBOO. Now, I don't know if you can do that, right, Erin? Erin's a program director, so I'd be criticizing her, but I just want to say...
But if there's something to criticize, then you should criticize it.
They have welcomed me back, Lenita Duke from Grassroots News, with open arms. I'm treated like an elder stateswoman, and I love it. Oh, my goodness, 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 I love it. And to keep the station going, to keep the kind of information flowing, we need your support. This is the only outlet in Multnomah County that airs Democracy Now! We need a counterbalance to what's going on in the world. We don't know what's going on. And even if there's a war, when the war starts, and some have said the war has been going on forever, since 1979 that I can remember. And we need the communication outlet such as KBOO, community-oriented news, community-oriented education. One thing I'm doing since I've been back, I've been wiping everything down. You would think I have a degree in public health. But I do have a degree, but it's not in public health. But we need to keep buying these wipes to keep KBOO safe and healthy. So give us a call. What is our number? It is 877-500-5266. You can hit us up online at kboo.fm, and it's quick and easy to donate to KBOO. Again, we have some wonderful gifts. If you can't do it all at once, you can do it monthly. $5 a month, $8 a month for a $100 donation, $10 a month. For $13 a month, which is yearly $150, we have some wonderful T-shirts, some wonderful hoodies. Yo, be the only one on your block with that kind of hoodie, son. Please, donate to KBOO, seriously. 877-500-5266. We need to go another 50 years, not just for me, because I'll be gone in a few years. I want to leave this planet knowing that I've made a contribution. Don't you want to leave this planet knowing that you made a contribution, Erin?
I absolutely do, and there's nothing like supporting KBOO at 877-500-5266 to support all kinds of issues and people. There's good politics, and then there's good music, and Rising Up with Sonali is this awesome team of women from Los Angeles.
That you won't hear anywhere else but on KBOO. 877-500-5266. Yo, we have Black Book Talk. Yo, we have Bike Talk. Yo, we have Prison Pipeline. Yo, we have a food talk show. And these are shows that are nationally syndicated, produced here at KBOO in Portland. So it's not just within your ears that this information is disseminated to. It's all over the world. 877-500-5266. Give us a call. Now I hear the phone ringing. Yay! 877-500-5266.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Sudan's longtime president, Omar al-Bashir, was ousted by a military coup. Months of mass protests, during which dozens of people were killed by security forces, paved the way for the ouster. Al-Bashir had himself come to power more than 30 years ago as a result of a military coup. In addition to national anger over his decades of rule, the ousted president was charged by the International Criminal Court over genocide in Darfur. Sudan's defense minister, Awad ibn Auf, has declared himself interim leader, saying that there would be a two-year transition period during which the military would remain in charge. Already the military has begun cracking down, however, with the imposition of a month-long curfew. We turn to Dr. Stephen Zunis. He's a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he also serves as coordinator of the program in Middle East Studies. And he's a senior policy analyst for Foreign Policy in Focus and associate editor of Peace Review. Welcome, Dr. Stephen Zunis.
Great to be with you again.
So let's first get a little bit of a history lesson on Sudan. Unfortunately, we don't hear enough or know enough here in the United States about the history of this country. I mentioned that al-Bashir had been ruling for about 30 years and had come to power as a result of a military coup. But his rule was, in a way, a very dark time for Sudan. Can you give us the highlights, or I should say the lowlights, of his dictatorship?
Well, Sudan, a former colony of Britain, a multi-ethnic society, though traditionally dominated by the Arabs in the north, received independence in the 1950s, and the military has intervened a number of times. So quite significantly, in both 1964 and 1965, the people rose up in an unarmed civil insurrection, similar to what we've seen in recent weeks, to bring down those dictatorships and usher in a period of multi-party democracy and political freedom. It was after the overthrow of the U.S.-backed Nameri dictatorship in 1985 that democracy governed that country for 4 years, making it one of the most democratic countries in the Arab world or in Africa, until the right-wing Islamist wing of the very broad civilian coalition ended up allying itself with the military and staged the coup that brought Bashir to power. And during this period, has overseen an enormous amount of turmoil, the secession of the southern part of the country to form the new nation of South Sudan, simultaneous civil wars, the worst of which, of course, was in Darfur, where a genocidal campaign by the Janjaweed militia, with direct support of the government, took place for quite a few years. It's still a bad situation, though the worst appears to be over. But Bashir's role in that made him the only sitting president in the world to be under indictment by the International Criminal Court. Meanwhile, domestic repression was quite severe. The once very strong trade union network and civil society networks that had existed in Sudan, even under some of the previous dictatorships, were brutally suppressed. And yet resistance continued. In 1998 and 2011 and 2012, there were aborted uprisings against the regime, due to increasing economic hardships and growing dissatisfaction with the regime and its corruption, its repression, and a whole new generation of Sudanese who've grown up under the regime and wanting change have come together and have forced Bashir's resignation.
So this latest series of protests, did it sort of reach a breaking point? I mean, I understand that it was, you know, as is the case with many such rebellions against longtime dictatorships, there might be one thing that sparks it, one action that seems to be the straw that breaks the camel's back, if you will, but still represents a very long-standing dissatisfaction and anger and resentment from the public?
Well, there's no one incident in this particular case, so that is certainly a phenomenon in some places. I think it was just yet another wave that they've had of these repeated waves of protests. But for various reasons, I think in large part the worsening economy gave it the critical mass that was really important. And what was also significant, I think, is that it went beyond Khartoum, the capital, and it's been taking place in urban areas throughout the country, and even including in some rather remote regions. You seemed to have the unity of professional workers and others who have been able to essentially bring the capital to a standstill. The sheer numbers were greater than ever before. And also significant is the unprecedented participation of women. By some estimates, the majority of protesters are women who, in addition to the other complaints the rest of Sudan has, they have been challenging the very sexist, patriarchal, conservative Islamist rule. And so it's been a real coming together of various parts of Sudanese society. And at this point, they had the numbers and the courage and whatever to bring down not the regime yet, but certainly the worst manifestation of the regime in the form of Omar Bashir. What's significant, I think, also about this is that you hear people say, well, nonviolence can work in thus and such situations, but not against a really, really brutal regime. But by almost every measure, Sudan ranks up there as one of the three or four most repressive regimes in the world. And another significant thing about this is, despite our stereotypes of, oh, this kind of thing can't work unless a society has a fairly high level of development and infrastructure and whatever, Sudan ranks near the bottom in the world in terms of the Human Development Index. That combined with the these ongoing armed conflicts around the country with the ultra-conservative Islamist rule, despite the limited internet and other technologies and low level of education, despite all these things, they show that even in these situations, that people, when they want change, when they're willing to face down the tanks with their bare hands, that people power can prevail.
I want to pick up on what you said about the role of women and ask you how they participated. There, of course, was this viral video of a young woman dressed in all white, addressing a huge crowd of protesters, singing a song about revolution that helped to break the story of Sudan into the international media. And in fact, let's watch a little bit and listen to a little bit of her her song. Very, very beautiful and inspiring song. I don't know if it's clear yet who she is, but here is the viral video of a Sudanese female protester. Watching a video of, or listening to a video of, a young Sudanese woman addressing a very large crowd gathered around her as she sings a song. Media have pointed out that on one of her cheeks is an older version of the Sudanese flag painted on her. How important was this moment that was captured on film and spread in media throughout the world? Sometimes this sort of symbolism can be quite inspiring, and but also give a lot of wind to the sails of a movement.
Well, it certainly is already become something of an iconic photo or video. That has indeed inspired a lot of people around the world and given an opportunity to pay attention to a country, though large and important in many ways, is generally ignored, particularly in the West. But I don't even think it was that big a deal in Sudan, simply because very few Sudanese have access to the internet and that kind of thing. I think sometimes there's a tendency in the West to overemphasize new technologies in terms of bringing these movements forward. But there was no internet, no social media during the uprisings in 1964 and 1985. This uprising would be happening anyway. Because when people believe there's freedom is denied, social justice is denied, they will be active. They will take to the streets. They will take these kinds of risks. And the fact is that again, despite our stereotypes we have in the West about Arabs or Africans or Muslims, regardless of your background, I mean, you know, people don't like to be oppressed. People don't like to have their rights denied, and. Women are often affected at least as much as men by this kind of repression and social injustice. So it's really not surprising that you see this kind of mass movement out there.
So let's talk about what has happened specifically around Omar al-Bashir's ouster. The military stepped in, and just as he came to power 30 years ago as a result of a military coup, we now have the defense minister of Sudan somewhat declaring power, and that's not really clear actually because it's so new what has happened, but essentially the military announced it would take over, announced a two-year transitional period, paving the way for elections, but also imposed a very strict curfew. You know, between at nighttime, no one's allowed to go out for a whole month. They have this curfew. They are apparently going to be enforcing it quite strictly. And we're hearing that members of the opposition or some leaders in the opposition are not happy, understandably so. How do you analyze this transition of power? Can the military be trusted?
No, it cannot. And most Sudanese recognize this. The military doesn't quite have the aura of the Egyptian military or the Algerian military.
And you brought up Egypt. Al-Sisi in Egypt actually praised what had happened in Sudan, which shouldn't be a good sign.
Right, exactly. And what's interesting, though, is that in 1985, when the masses rose up and overthrew the Nimeiri regime, a very similar thing happened. The military came in and formally deposed him and said, okay, the dictator's gone, we're in charge now, y'all can go home. And the Sudanese people said, we're staying. We're going to keep on protesting until you have a transition to civilian rule. And within a week, that's exactly what happened. The military stepped down and made the transition to a temporary representative civilian government, which then organized the elections a few months later. And so and it's very clear from all the communication I've heard is that the Sudanese who have been out in the streets do not see this as the end of the struggle at all, that they realize that it must continue. It could be a protracted struggle even, but they're not buying the line that everything's cool now that the military is in power. Indeed, the defense chief who's taken over is himself responsible for some of the worst atrocities in Darfur and elsewhere, and people aren't buying it. I mean, it is possible that the military could crack down. We could see a massacre. I mean, there is a pretty high level of danger still. But it's been significant that the protesters indeed have not gone home. They have been disobeying the curfew that's been imposed. And another significant point, I think, is that there is a whole new generation of younger officers who, even if they are ordered to crack down by the interim leadership, they won't necessarily obey these orders. There are already reports that there are some units who are very dissatisfied with what happened, and they're supporting the Sudanese people and calling for a genuine transition to democratic civilian rule.
How organized is the opposition? 30 years is a long time to live under a dictatorship, but of course, if you have a repressive dictatorship, organizing is also very, very difficult to do. Do you get the sense that there is, you know, are there political parties that are organizing or that could emerge or maybe could be formed from the basis of existing organizational structures?
Well, this is the big challenge right now, because and when you had these popular pro-democracy uprisings in 1964 and 1985, even though these also took place under military dictatorships, you still had a strong trade union movement. You had a controlled but somewhat independent judiciary. You had civil society organizations were vibrant, but under Bashir, it's been basically decimated civil society organizations, and so many ways, the people who are organizing today are doing so from scratch, and so it's going to be more difficult, I think, unfortunately, than in these previous struggles. But what's remarkable about this is that it is more diverse in the sense that you have it's intergenerational. Again, you have a lot of women involved. That's taking place not just in the capital, but across the country. And these are people who, having lived under this regime for quite a few years, have learned how to improvise, have learned how to get around all the restrictions and avoid the repressions. And as I also mentioned earlier, you know, there have been several aborted uprisings during the past 30 years. And so they also have a good idea of what doesn't work. And I think the lessons learned from these decades of struggle will be to their advantage, because from everything I can tell, they're determined to win this time.
Has there been a role by diaspora Sudanese around the world in helping their fellow countrymen in this grassroots organization, or has this been primarily led by those people inside?
It's certainly been primarily an internal struggle, but there is a fairly large educated Sudanese diaspora that has had to flee under the decades of this repression. People who still have close ties to their homeland, and for the minority of Sudanese who do have access to social media, there's been a lot of communication and support financially and otherwise. So this is very much an internal struggle, but it's important to have allies overseas, and indeed the Sudanese diaspora appears to be rising to the occasion.
What will happen to Omar al-Bashir? He has been arrested. There are numerous examples we could look back on in just the last 10 years or so for what ends up happening to deposed dictators. Most of them don't end up in a good place, but some basically live out the rest of their lives in house arrest or whatever.
It's hard to say. I mean, currently the regime says they're not going to turn him over to the International Criminal Court, I think in large part because a trial would implicate some of them as well for massive war crimes. But at the same time, there's an advantage to them to make him seem like a scapegoat. Like he was the bad guy, it was all his fault, and so we'll punish him for corruption or whatever. But again, I don't think the interim government is going to be in power that long, and what a new democratic Sudan should it emerge, inshallah, we can. It'll be interesting to see what they do in regard to him and to the others who have oppressed them for so long.
Well, Stephen Zunis, always a pleasure to have you on and sharing your depth of knowledge about so many different issues. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Once again, my pleasure.
My guest has been Dr. Stephen Zunis, Professor of Politics and International Studies at the University of San Francisco, where he serves as the coordinator of the program in Middle Eastern Studies. He's also Senior Policy Analyst for Foreign Policy in Focus and Associate Editor of Peace Review. We've been discussing primarily the political crisis and transition of power in Sudan with a little bit of Israel thrown in at the end. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter, subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes, and our video channel on Vimeo.
And you are listening to Rise Up with Sonali here on KBOO Portland. This is our spring membership drive. My name is Erin Yankee, and we also have Lenita Duke to help you help support KBOO at 877-500-5266.
I am truly humbled by what I just heard. And we hear a lot of, we focus, we broadcast, we promote. That's our platform. Shows like The Struggle, shows like Rising Up. Now, nationally, there are shows that we produce here locally with our local producers that are broadcast nationally on a satellite. You set them up on AudioPort, and stations all around the country pull them down. Now, that's my job here at KBOO. 5 hours a week, I listen to these wonderful, wonderful shows that you can listen to. And I'm asking you to keep these shows on the air so we can disseminate information, so we can disseminate education across, not just across the country, but across the world. That's amazing what KBOO can do. I got to give it up to our engineering staff. These cats are on point when it comes to our sound quality. These cats are on point when it comes to, you know, our equipment, analog, and non-analog, what's that called?
Digital.
Right? Linear and non-linear, yeah. Audio production. It's amazing what we can do right now. And dig this, I'm 2 days older than smoke. I remember editing with a reel-to-reel and a razor blade. Now, if you got love for a reel-to-reel and a razor blade editing, give us a call at 877-500-5266. I have seen how audio editing has changed, and seeing how it's used, the information being disseminated here locally at KBOO. You know, I'm from Portland, Erin, and the one thing Portlanders do, we take each other for granted. Don't take KBOO for granted. Pledge 877-500-5266. Now, we do have some wonderful people I want to thank and show our gratitude. These ladies, these wonderful human beings, they do not take KBOO for granted. Jennifer in Northeast Portland and Kaylee in Northeast Portland. Yay. Yo, yo, we got nothing but love for y'all. Nothing but love. And they are reflecting their admiration and love to keep this information disseminated. 877-500-5266. Or hit us up on the internet. KBOO.FM. Is that right? You just
yeah.
Do that?
There's a big button that says donate, or you can just go straight to KBOO.FM/give, and you will fill out a little form, and then you'll get an email when you know we've got it, so you know it'll all work out. You can check the information, and then you're a supporter of KBOO. And what we bring to you on a daily, minute-by-minute basis, Rising Up with Sonali is produced in L.A., and we do pay to broadcast this show as part of the Pacifica Network. But like Lenita was saying, your support for our local programmings gives up the opportunity to have our shows play all over the country. For instance, I know Rose City Native Radio is played.
Rose City Native Radio, Labor Radio, Locust Focus, Prison Pipeline, Progressive Spirit, Beloved Community, one of our wonderful monthly shows. The Bike Show is amazing. Voices for the Animals. When do you have a show that turns the mic over to the animals? That's Voices for the Animals. However, they use human beings to translate, right?
Oh, yeah, I think they do, yeah.
So, but we need to support those shows. And what's wonderful about these shows, Labor Radio, Locust Focus, Prison Pipeline, Progressive Spirits, Rose City Native Radio, Beloved Community, The Bike Show, Voices for the Animals, and The Food Show, these are all shows produced here at KBOO by local intellectuals, by local producers, by local activists. These are amazing human beings. Oh my God, they're so creative. These cats are so creative that I'm going to take some of their best shows, with their permission, of course, and submit them for national and international awards. In Portland, we take things for granted. Let's not take KBOO for granted. 877-500-5266, or hit us up online, kboo.fm. Don't you think we take each other for granted?
I do. I think it's really easy to just get into that casual Portland, like, oh, it's fine. Oh, this is okay. And then we get bored and then we start picking at each other. And that is no good. It's not healthy for the movement. It's not healthy for us as individuals. We should be able to criticize each other, but to build on it constructively. And that is part of, like, kind of how KBOO is here to educate us on past movements, on what's going on now, so that we can learn from people's mistakes and build on them instead of keep creating them over and over or feel like we're isolated and alone. This is happening all over the world. People are struggling, people are fighting, and people are rising up with Sonali, for
instance.
They are
rising up. They are agitating for social change. There's a wonderful show that comes on before mine called The Struggle. And she'll be on in less than about 30 minutes talking about her show. I'm honored to pitch with her. As an oldster, it's so nice to see a new generation come up and agitate. Because I think about people like Ronnie Herndon from the Black United Front and all the work they did. And here I'm coming up right behind them. I think about my show. My daughter now is a faith reporter. But the best thing I like about my show, and I got to give love to my show, we got Professor Soul calling in from the planet of rhythm and blues. I got the Prophet of Rage. I got the Faith Report. I have my mental health consultant, Cheryl Jefferson. But the one, and those are all wonderful, talented, amazing human beings that need your support. 877-500-5266. The best part of From the Grassroots is the last 10 seconds when my grandchild does my outro, where she says, From the Grassroots is produced by Grassroot News Northwest in Portland, Oregon. That to me says it all. 877-500-5266. And yes, she is 6 years old, and it's amazing she can do that. Hit us up online, KBOOFM. Let's not take this station, let's not take our talents, let's not take our activism for granted.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. On Monday, April 15th, a week of events taking place in major cities around the world aims to draw attention to the existential climate crisis that we face. Extinction Rebellion, born in the UK last year, uses direct action to make demands of governments, now spreading to countries like Germany, France, South Africa, New Zealand, Canada, and the United States. The climate activists of Extinction Rebellion have a singular message of declaring, quote, an international non-violent rebellion against the world's governments for criminal inaction on the ecological crisis. They want a zero emissions energy economy in 5 years. Here are some of the scenes of Extinction Rebellion's actions in various cities.
Morgen von Fridays for Future hier in Berlin. Es haben sich hier wieder hunderte Schülerinnen und Schüler, aber auch Eltern und Studierende
versammelt.
System change, not climate change!
System change, not climate change!
We are lying down today to fight for climate justice. The people contributing the least to climate change suffer the most from it.
And those are scenes from actions organized by Extinction Rebellion around the world. We turn now to Giselle Gonzalez and Jennifer Wong. They're organizers with Extinction Rebellion LA. Welcome to the program, Jennifer and Giselle.
Thank you.
So to first begin by giving us a sort of history lesson around Extinction Rebellion. I mentioned that it began last year in the UK. London was the birthplace for this movement or organization. What exactly is Extinction Rebellion and how did it start?
Extinction Rebellion is a non-hierarchical, worldwide, direct action network of people trying to address the climate crisis and ecological crisis facing all the animals and humans in the world. It started out of the Occupy movement from a group called Rising Up in the UK, and then Extinction Rebellion was born from Rising Up. Rising Up is basically just about empowering people and encouraging agency, and that was around 2015. And then I think last year in 2018 was when Extinction Rebellion launched in the UK, and then on January 26th of 2019 was when we started chapters in the United States.
And so the basis of this movement, I understand, is of course the fact that we are in a climate crisis that's unfolding all around us, right? I mean, right now as we're talking, there's a bomb cyclone, the second of the year, that has hit huge parts of the U.S. How do you express the urgency of what we are facing right now? It seems as though our politicians don't seem to get that urgency. Jennifer?
That's a really good question. I think Extinction Rebellion, we in L.A. recognize that we have a lot of privilege and power as people living in the so-called developed world, and that gives us the responsibility to change the system that is murdering people around the world and here in the US, here in LA. LA has the largest oil field in the US, and the LA County Department of Public Health report has said that many of us are living right next to poorly maintained and poorly capped oil wells that cause cancer and lung problems in our loved ones. So we believe that it's our duty to put our lives on the line to demand a system change that values each other's lives over that of property and corporations. That doesn't necessarily mean getting arrested, but we are willing to get arrested through a diverse toolbox of actions.
So direct action, I understand, is a major tool. The call that I mentioned earlier, International Nonviolent Rebellion Against the World's Governments, how does that actually play out? Can you give us a sense, Giselle, of what took place in London last year in terms of how people marched on the streets, got arrested? What did that direct action, what did that rebellion look like, and what can it look like going forward?
I think in the actions that they've had in the UK, it's looked a lot like building from the bottom instead of trying to seek out the people who are in power, who are enforcing the system that is working the way it's supposed to work, but it's not working in the sense that it's respecting life. So trying to empower people, give them agency, and that means building community together, being on the streets together, finding that the collective is strong through, you know, protests, through direct actions like blockading, and you know, even things as weird and fun as costumes or performance art in conjunction with direct action. And going forward, we hope to use those tactics to do the same thing, create community, empower each other, build from the bottom, and also escalate and change the conversation, because the crisis is happening now. It's not a future event. People are dying now because of this crisis. We don't have 12, 11 years to fix it. It's already happening. So we need to escalate the conversation by using our voices and our bodies in a way that can really, you know, make people address the issue with the severity that it's actually affecting people.
So let's talk about what's supposed to happen. April 15th through the 22nd, you and I are here in Los Angeles. We have a national audience, and these actions, April 15th through the 22nd, are taking place in cities around the world. Can you give us a sense of what's expected to happen both globally and locally?
Globally, the demands are for governments and media to recognize the climate crisis and alert citizens to the crisis and develop a plan to curb all emissions by 2025. So we're going to be doing direct actions throughout the week internationally. And then here in LA, we are really excited to have a climate camp where we're going to be teaching each other how to do direct action. We're going to have nonviolent direct action trainings on what to expect, how to liaison with the police if that's necessary, how to make art and banners to get the message out, write letters to media. And we're also really excited and honored to be working with frontline communities in LA, like Stand LA and East Yard Communities for Environmental Justice, because we recognize that they've been doing this work for many years. So we're going to be on Tuesday, we're going to be supporting Stand LA's action at City Hall in LA. We're going to travel to East Yard to meet with them and see how we can support their efforts. We recognize that climate justice is an intersectional issue, and we need to continue to educate ourselves and each other and our communities on what that means so that we can better support each other through this struggle for climate justice.
And are there other cities in the United States and other parts of the country that are also part of this movement and part of the Week of Actions, April 15th through the 22nd?
Yes, there's over 15 other cities, I think many more than that, but definitely somewhere between 15 to 25, I believe.
And so that information can be found on a website, or is there a place that people can find out more about it?
Yes, at extinctionrebellion.us. You can go and see whatever region or area you're in, and you can see what existing group is there.
That's extinctionrebellion.us, a series of actions taking place April 15th through the 22nd, making demands around the climate. Well, let's give out that website one more time for people to find out, no matter where they are, whether in LA or in other parts of the country, where can they find out about Extinction Rebellion's series of actions?
extinctionrebellion.us.
And we'll link to that from our website as well. I want to thank the two of you very much for joining us. Good luck to you.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
My guests have been Giselle Gonzalez and Jennifer Wong. They're both organizers with Extinction Rebellion LA. And we've been discussing the week-long series of events taking place around the world, including here in the United States, from April 15th through the 22nd. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Kitsap. Like us on facebook.com/RUWithSonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RUWithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files.
Special thanks to our local community partners who've donated food for our volunteers today. Breakfast was provided by Gravy, with locations in Boise at 3957 North Mississippi Avenue and in Kearns at 3101 Northeast Sandy Boulevard. Serving traditional American breakfast and brunch, both locations are open daily from 7:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. Lunch was provided by Atlas Pizza, located at 3570 Southeast Division Street, open 11:30 a.m. to 11 p.m. or later every day. More information at atlaspizzapdx.com. Dinner was provided by Di Nicola's, located in the Creston Kenilworth neighborhood at 3520 Southeast Powell Boulevard. Di Nicola's authentic Italian restaurant has been a family-run Portland institution for over 40 years, serving classic Italian cuisine and pizza, open daily from 4 p.m. to 9 p.m. or later. For more information on how you can support KBOO, call 877-500-5266 right now.
We are corporate America. We will suppress all independent voices. We are corporate America. We will suppress all independent voices.
choices.
Is this what you want? Cable needs you now more than ever. Call and pledge.
You're listening to KBOO in Portland, 90.7 FM on your radio dial. Yo, yo, I love that promo. This is what will happen if KBOO is not supported. Listen to this. That's right. You don't hear anything. We cannot take KBOO for granted. We need your support. We have these pledge drives twice a year, right, Aaron? Just twice a year. Don't say three times.
Don't ask me. This year we had two. This is the second one this fiscal year. This is all we're having this year.
Right. And you know, fiscal years are kind of cock-ass backwards anyway. So this is our annual pledge drive, and we need your support. I want to give love and thanks to Jennifer and Kaylee. They got on the phone, their little cell phones, and one was so intelligent and so suave that they were able to pledge on the internet, kboo.fm. Call us, 877-500-5266. I am not hearing from any of our old school analog engineers. I need to hear from folks that remember reel-to-reel tape. I need to hear from folks who remember editing reel-to-reel tape on a splicing block with this white tape. And as soon as you put the tape down, it disappeared on the reel-to-reel tape. That's how I learned how to edit. And I raised my daughter down here at KBOO. I raised her down here from the time she was about 5 years old till she was a young adult, and now she's our faith reporter. Can I tell you a story, Aaron? Now, this is a crazy KBOO story.
Oh, I love these.
You know, when I first started, I was on this show with this cat named J.W. Friday. And on the weekends, he would do the, you know, R&B, soul, beginning of rap. And I would come on every hour and do news. And I first started, I was so full of enthusiasm and joy, and I transitioned from just doing the news with my name to Grassroot News. And during that time, in 1980, I started in 79, 1980, we had Mount St. Helens blow up. If you remember Mount St. Helens blowing up, give to KBOO, 877-500-5266. But that's not the story. In 1980, as ash was all around Portland, KBOO was still going. And I worked on Saturday night with my little daughter, and I would do the news. And then in the summer of 1980, it came to an abrupt end. Now, this was right around the town, because Mount St. Helens blew up May 18, 1980. I remember that because the very next day, we had a school boycott, May 19th, 1980. And it was the first time that I knew where black people in Portland, not just African Americans, but a lot of people in Portland stuck together, and we boycotted the Portland Public Schools to dismantle a school busing program that just bused black children to unknown neighborhoods to attend unfamiliar schools just for the sake of desegregation. But that's not the story either. During that time, and I covered that, was my very first story as a journalist.
Wow.
The story I want to tell is this. I was all enthusiastic. We just had a boycott May 19th. And then in June, I quit. Because my grandmother got sick, and she needed someone to take care of her. Now, I am the prodigal daughter with this other daughter, and I moved back home to take care of her. And of all the things I've ever done in my life, that is the most significant thing I have ever done. Not having a daughter, not starting Grassroot News, not winning awards. That, taking care of my grandmother, is the most significant thing I have ever done and that I will ever do. And if you've taken care of a loved one, if you interrupted your flow to take care of someone who took care of you, give us a call at 877-500-5266. I got all my activism from her. I once asked her, who was the black person she most admired? And I thought she would say Martin Luther King, but she said it was Stokely Carmichael. I was shocked. I said, why Stokely Carmichael? And she told me, now, is this a black woman from the Deep South, Forest, Mississippi? She said that Stokely Carmichael said, and this is true, this is what Stokely Carmichael said, if somebody hits him, he's going to hit them back. And of course, it was Stokely Carmichael that started the phrase black power. And I cannot believe that out of that activism touched the heart of this old black woman from Forest, Mississippi, whose grandparents were on the plantation, whose mother, whose grandmother was born in slavery. She came out here like many African Americans. They come out here to the Pacific Northwest to work on the railroads and the shipyards. And they go to Northeast Portland and they get gentrified. That's the life of a black person in Portland, Oregon. But we have outlets to express ourselves creatively, and KABU is one of those outlets, and we need to keep it going. 877-500-5266, or hit us up on the internet, kboo.fm. I don't know why I said that, but I just brought that, this whole thing, and brought that back. And so I just wanted to say that and give love to her somewhere in the universe and let people know that KABU's been around and we cannot take it for granted. Mm-hmm. We cannot take it for granted. We need to support it. And this is our second annual pledge drive, 877-500-5266. Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you, Kaylee. We have some wonderful prizes. We want to support our local news shows such as Labor Radio, Democracy Now!, Locus Focus, Prison Pipeline, Progressive Spirits, Rose City Native Radio, wonderful show, our beloved community show, The Bike Show, Voices for the Animals, and Food Show. Now, these are shows that we produce here locally and we syndicate nationally and internationally. We need your help. These are wonderful shows, very creative producers. They don't know how good they are, and I'm going to help persuade them that they are good and they're going to get better. And we need your support. 877-500-5266.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. Up next is the story.